This is a production of Cornell University.
UA meeting, September 29th, 2010.
Which I realize is hard, assembly such as this, to be orderly, but we should try. Apparently, President Scorton is going to be here around 5:30 or so. So we should get our business done as best we can before he appears. And having the agenda in front of me, I call for late additions to the agenda. Good, because there isn't any time anyway. The second item, or the third item, is the approval of minutes from September 1st, 2010. Has anybody looked at the minutes from 2010?
I did. I want to thank you, Charlie, for putting my 2 cents in the
order. I have nothing to do with it.
But
great. Do I hear a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Wonderful. Opposed? Good. Business of the day, the President's Gordon discussion, that will be postponed until he gets here. So we then move along to staff committees. Ed, you were...
Yeah. So just to follow up, we've thankfully have liaisons to all of the committees. So Will, if you were still willing to be liaison to CJC, I'll be liaison to TAC. Mike will be liaison to the University Sustainability Committee, Randy to campus planning, and Jared has so kindly volunteered to be liaison to both family services and the child care subcommittee. So the only follow-up then is I do have the list of who is assigned to staff each of these committees that Ari so nicely printed up. So I'll pass these around later at the end of the meeting, but basically a number of the seats are still unstaffed from the different constituencies. So if you would just look in the extreme left column of this piece of paper, and if a faculty member isn't on, you know, say the Family Services Committee, please talk to your constituents and see if you know of a name, figure out how we can get these all staffed and up and running. So that's basically it. Mm-hmm.
Who calls the first meeting of the committee?
The liaison is the convener. So, yeah, the liaisons, we should get in contact with everybody. Thankfully, most everybody, Will and Jared will get you contact information to, I would imagine, CJC is already well established. Liaison is the convener. So.
And the second question is, I've made suggestions for faculty members on the University Sustainability Committee back in the summertime, pass them on to the Dean of Faculty's office. I've had no response from them.
I would keep at it, Marty. I suspect the reason is nominations and elections probably hasn't met. And if you don't get any response, I would go to the Associate Dean of the Faculty, who is Chair of the Nominations and Elections Committee, Fred Golden, and put a B in Fred's bonnet.
So again, just to reiterate, if you take a look at this, anything that says unassigned on the left-hand column means it hasn't received a member yet. So please take a look at that. Okay? That's all I have for committees.
Good. Anything more about committees from the assembled multitude?
We will hear more about committees later.
Yes, we will revisit the interesting subject of committees in due course. Thanks to Ed, he has compiled a list of all the comments that we have received concerning the charter. So I'm going to ask him if he'd be kind enough to go through that
see
what people think about.
Yeah, so I'm basically just working off the list. So if anybody wants to jump in, feel free to. So I emailed this list out to everybody, gathered input, if you remember, about this from all the members here, and that email also went out to the leaders of the other assemblies. So this is, as far as I know, the full extent of feedback which we got on this draft of the charter. So nothing looks too like a giant thorn sticking out. But I'll just run over it, a couple of things, and hopefully I don't miss anything. One item that somebody mentioned is, and if there's no serious objections, I think that probably the working plan will be here. If there's no serious objections, we'll task Ari, the executive committee, we'll sit down, put out some ideas on maybe how to incorporate this, task Ari with working out some wording and, you know, resolve some of these just minor issues. So one of the issues was raised by one of the current student elected trustees, just basically asked that clearly the trustees, you know, get emails from this. They have an interest in the university assembly, but there's no mention as far as the student trustees or even any of the constituency elected trustees being ex officio members. So maybe they should just be stipulated as ex officio members of the body. Any thoughts one way or the other there? My inclination is doesn't hurt mention them as ex officio. There was a graduate student brought up the idea that since we're proposing changing membership terms to 2 years, this limits, there's a significant portion of master's degree students. Some are only here for 2 years. Others are here for 3 year terms. So 2 years kind of limits the prospects of master's degree students. And there were a couple of, so I'm not really sure if anybody has any thoughts on that. I haven't really engaged yet with the graduate students who mentioned that, exactly how to remedy it. My gut instinct, yeah?
I'm sorry, I'm trying to make sure I understand the issue. The issue is, if I'm here for 2 years and I miss my window to be elected to the assembly, the next year I don't have time to sit on my term, is that the...
Exactly.
All right.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, I would imagine my first year here, I basically didn't even know the university assembly existed, right? So it takes you a little while to get your feet on this stuff. My inclination on that, and that's just my inclination, is myself, Mike, you know, any graduate student who sits here represents graduate and professional students. You know, I don't just represent graduate students, I represent graduate and professional students. So, but I'll engage further on that if anybody has any comments. Well, there were a couple of comments that basically related to culture of the UA and how we would go about following this up rather than just changing the document. I think this is a good point. Rather than just changing the document, what's the game plan forward? How do we engage people, get the full buy-in, make sure that in the future this is a well-staffed, lively body? Culture change is significantly more difficult than just changing words on a document. And so we do definitely need to think about that game plan going forward. I would expect that we all rely upon each other to talk to our constituencies, but if we could figure out some thought, yeah.
Maybe not understanding the exact undertone of the comments, but I think the way that the revised charter is structured lends to some of the concerns that seem to raise. One, that the heads of the different constituents were involved with the committee, so they are, by de facto, a direct connection. But also, we have attendance requirements more specifically spelled out and much more streamlined. If somebody is not here, you know, procedures for replacing them with somebody who is actively engaged. I don't know that you can codify a culture.
Yeah, you can't.
But you can build structures that support an active body, and if they're enforced, I thought there were reasonable structures built in to underpin that.
Yeah.
It was based on the comment I saw, and so I may have missed intent.
I think that is, the exec body definitely over the summer talked about that. Like, the role here would be to give it the tools to be as effective as possible, and I think you're hitting exactly what our sentiment was.
And the other idea was to strengthen the committees by making sure that the chairs were members of this body, and thirdly, the final scheme, it seems to me, is to have the heads of the other assemblies as part of this body. That all of that seems to me to strengthen communication.
So one other thing which was brought up, and there's been a little bit of talk about this, and this one I think warrants some more consideration. It was in one of the bodies, so you may not have noticed it. The idea that future revisions to the charter might need, we should consider that future revisions to the charter we might want them to be ratified by the other constituencies. So instead, so this way, future membership changes, say, future decrees of authority, that all the other assemblies would need to ratify our changes to the charter. That one, I don't know. It was brought up at least once in the summertime, but we clearly left it out. And so if anybody has thoughts that way or the other. I know that was also brought up by a graduate student at the end of last year, one of the UA members, Bernita, who sat last year on the UA, she suggested that as well. So does anybody have any, do you understand what I'm saying? Like, we've made such a smaller, tighter charter now and put a lot of the details into the bylaws. And so the idea here is that the change, the solid foundational document you would need, because we've taken out the requirement for a campus referendum. So kind of adding a middle ground back there. Yeah.
Is there a precedent for that with the other assemblies? Like, I just feel like I would be reluctant at first to let the other assemblies make their ultimate decision on something that we know the most about.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I don't think there is a precedent anywhere for that.
What was the rationale?
So when Bernita mentioned it, and I gave it some thought, and this actually comment, I hope you don't mind, Mike, that comment came from Mike, and we're all graduate students, but it was not by design that all came from graduate students. For me, the thought is that there's a solid foundational document, and to change that as firmly as possible, only under times when you really do need to change it, whereas the bylaws can change much more fluidly. I don't know what your reasoning, Mike, was.
I think we focus on our own internal culture and certainly improve that as best we can with this, you know, the change that we call for in the document. But as we move forward and to do the success that I think we need and we should have and the university deserves is to really get the constituencies to buy into this and to get the buy-in cooperative partnership that is UA and saying that it's not just, you know, this group of people who meet, you know, once a month a day long. This is a shared partnership between each of the constituencies at Cornell and each of the assemblies that represent those constituencies.
But on these people, I have a call, I'm sorry. But I'm all of us meeting, though, we represent our constituencies.
So
what's the difference?
And again, those assemblies that also represent constituencies buy into what we're doing as well.
You know, it's a difference between could this organization usurp authority that it shouldn't or not, versus the speed with which it takes to make adjustments. Now, is it in charter or bylaws, or would it affect both?
My opinion would be just the charter.
And the charters list the committees.
The charter.
Child care on. That seems to be where we have our most dynamics. We need to create a committee on this. Dissolve a non-functioning committee or no longer need a committee on that. Is that in the bylaws or in the other part?
Well, maybe the best thing is to keep this on your mind, because we're going to talk about committees too for actually exactly that reason, is how fluid should and can committees be to camp stuff. That was probably, I think Charlie and I were discussing, probably the biggest piece of input we got, the closest to significantly changing the charter right now from what we have, is a committee structure input idea. And so I think that if we favor the idea of, well, I'll get into it, but it's more committees versus less committees. Mm-hmm. And I think if we favor the idea of less committees with more sort of fluidity and a broad scope, then it's probably less of a problem to have to require ratification by the other assemblies.
Well, I guess there's important and there's truly important.
Yeah.
And there's a level where you want a certified buy-in. But things like committee creating and dissolving committees, I wouldn't want to have to go to referendum to the other assemblies. Yeah. If that's the way, I would recommend if you scope such that we don't hamper ourselves for the things we really know will change every couple of years or whatever, versus something that may change every 8 or 9 years. And perhaps a hybrid solution for some level of this might be that it'll be transmitted to the other organizations and they have 30 days to support or not comment or denounce the proposed thing to President Scorton before he decides whether or not to act or not or send it back for more staffing.
That's an interesting one.
And give them a way to formally tell him that they looked at it, considered it from their perspective, and they want more time to consult a larger thing, or they think it's a bad idea, or no, we're all good. You know, and that might allow for a more efficient, you know, something controversial to actually get looked at and something not controversial to move through in a relatively streamlined fashion.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I hadn't thought of that. That's an interesting one.
That's an interesting one.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that this doesn't happen in summer session, you know.
Yeah.
But there's probably ways to structure it where the committees have their opportunity to comment, and if they take their responsibilities seriously, then mm-hmm. President Scorton gets the advice he needs before signing off.
Yeah. Yeah. Mike, did you?
I think one of the things to think of as we move forward, especially when it comes to committees and these areas of authority, is great. I think as Charter has, the current draft that we have right now, as the committees are defined in the bylaws and the areas of authority are defined in the charter. And what that, I think, helps in my mind is the FAA has this CIT committee. And we also want to have a CIT committee, not just pick on anyone in CIT who's in the room right now, but this can create a lot of different degrees of confusion when we have these separate committees, duplication of efforts. I see the UA as being the central location where each of the constituencies come to say that this is the area that we realize is important to us, but we also realize that it's important to other people at this university as well, other constituencies. So we're asking the UA as a body to kind of digest these issues and think them over so we can kind of come to the best best solution or the best plan for these areas of shared concern.
I would agree with that, but I would also say that we had issues last year where the scope of committees was vastly different. Like sustainability, we were thinking in a very campus-wide area, and I'm not sure whether those undergraduate or graduate students had dorm by dorm or building by building late turnoff campaign concerns. And so they wanted the committee to deal with that in a very different way that we wouldn't, the University Assembly would have no interest in stopping that or trying to control that or requiring some report out. In other words, the graduate students feel they need to do that. They should be able to do that. They don't need UA's authority to do that. If they have something that's of a certain scope, they'll be more effective if they use the UA. But they should never be required to use the UA if they feel they need to do. I mean, they need to do what they feel they need to do. And in some cases, the scope is different enough that the UA would need no help on them. You know, yeah, we all agree we should turn that the show cop lights shouldn't be on at 2 a.m. when there's nobody on the field. But the UA would struggle to deal with that real practical matter, as opposed to requiring a sustainability review of every campus project before it's enacted. Recommending something like that to the university, or the silver or gold kind of consideration. So as long as you don't stifle it, we need everybody to understand the governance structure, but we all want to be effective, but we also need to realize that the graduates or undergraduates have a particular flair. Have at it. We should be careful not to stifle that creativity as well.
Well, I agree, because I don't think the SA and the GPSA and the UA need to be involved in a lot of different things that go on around campus support creativity. But I'm again focusing on governance at the university and what this does to affect directly my constituency and the university as a whole.
Certainly policy issues.
Yeah.
There's certainly certain things that rise to the test.
Yeah.
That's hard to codify in a very succinct way. They can always connect and
Marty?
This sort of ties in my mind with the thoughts that some people expressed about the size of the assembly
mm-hmm.
and the relationship of the proportionate membership from different constituencies. I think, you know, what's coming clear in the discussion is that there's a difference between the goals and the perceptions and the energies of the respective constituency assemblies, particularly the graduate student and graduate professional and undergraduates who are here for a limited period of time, and the employees and faculty who one assumes are here for longer, though a lot of faculty, you know, leave or quicker than that, but that's another issue. The point is, though, this is not to say that graduate and undergraduate students and don't have long-term concerns, but it is to say that the other constituencies may well think longer term and more comprehensively, and that this body is designed to embed shorter term ideas and efforts in longer term plans and have some kind of effect. I mean, that's an ideal statement, but it's one that I sort of thought was the purpose of so speaking to that, that to me argued that we shouldn't change the proportion, because right now granted it's not proportional representation, there are more students than there are faculty on the campus, but there is a student assembly, I think the university assembly has the responsibility to think, as I said, comprehensively across constituencies, and it would make sense for it to keep that proportion representation, the proportion of representation that it has, for that reason.
Not to cut you off.
Yeah, sorry.
Maybe can we hold that for, just because my mind works in a linear fashion, can we, so I don't lose where we are, because we're definitely going to get to the change in proportion.
Yeah, no, but I guess what I'm saying is it relates to this point in the sense that the University Assembly Constitution and bylaws is really about a sort of longer-term vision, and the kinds of things that it gets involved in, as Jim was saying, are sort of broader in their scope. And I don't quite understand what it is that you're trying to get at in terms of modifying the Constitution, but it would make sense for it to be a separate document, and that it not be needed to be ratified by other assemblies.
Okay. So it doesn't seem to be a whole lot of perception on that idea right now. That general idea. I mean, that's something that should always be revisited too, right? So that's just not something to immediately put Ari to task. Yeah?
One thing I was going to suggest, and this comment speaks to it, but I received feedback earlier from a student, was having some sort of notice requirement that you know, in addition to saying that you can't pass changes at the same meeting as they're proposed, perhaps saying changes must be publicized at least one meeting. There's at least a guarantee of notice that would allow people to come to the meeting and tell you what they think.
Sure. And actually, that would make me a little bit more agreeable, because my big concern is the potential changing of membership, right, which we're going to get to talking about. But if you distribute the information so that the constituency, which would get the short end of the stick, find out, you'll very quickly get their reaction. So, okay. So maybe we'll consider something more of a middle ground. Another matter which was brought up were two things. That the current draft basically removes authority. And then another member mentioned the third thing, so I'll mention all three together. Removes explicitly academic matters, budget and planning, and the CURW, so Cornell United Religious Works. And we've had a lot of discussions about academic matters in this body in past year. Not a whole lot, but basically budget and planning. And so I'll give you the quick rationale. Academic matters was removed because it was kind of like, this is the purview of faculty. They have a long-established history here. It's maybe not the area which the university assembly has a strong role for, but I suspect we're about to talk about that. Budget and planning and CURW were removed because those have basically been dormant activities. CURW, we haven't had a relationship in a number of years. And same with budget and planning. Budget and planning basically are we equipped to really understand the budgets of the university? So those three things were removed, and I'm sure we have opinions on all of that. Do we want to start with academic matters?
I'd say just every constituency that's a member of where UA has an interest in academic matters. And yes, that's the reason why I'm here. I mean, everybody at the university is here because there's an interest in academic matters. And there's some academic matters that transcend the faculty senate or not of interest to the faculty senate. Or the faculty senate may be interested, but they're busy with other things. And I think it's really good checks and balances to have the assembly also have a foot in the door in talking about academic matters.
I forgot to mention, just because things aren't stipulated in the charter, it does also say that the university assembly can make comments and recommendations on any matter which affects the community. So we're really talking about removing that, but I just forgot to mention
but
there was that.
That note, we could just say the university assembly exists.
Exactly.
and no need to discuss anything else.
Well,
and I would say academic matters rises to the importance of inclusion
of being clearly stipulated.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
yeah, I would definitely agree with that one. I think that if the rationale is that academics aren't really in the hands of faculty, that's okay, and I think most people would agree with that, but at the same time, I think UA serves as a vehicle for other constituent groups, like graduate and undergraduate students who otherwise wouldn't really have any input in academic matters, and I don't think it can hurt for it to be spelled out in the charter that there's still some, like, that UA still has some governance for input in that field.
I wouldn't want one of the other constituents to say, you can't talk about that, that's ours.
Okay.
At the same time, I do think that 99% of it probably does resolve and should resolve in the faculty senate. And any serious issue that I think they would undertake, especially if we recommended it, you know. But I it's one of those things that people would comment, you know, such as
yeah, I just wanted to mention that I agree with what everyone has said, Randy, Jimmy, Will. We can't just keep our back in the center. We can't. You know what I mean? Part of the university's community. So it's got to be mentioned in some way, somehow.
Okay.
And we all know that I think President Scort is going to, I mean, and he has, and it's one of the issues that we brought up a little bit last year, in a way. I referred that to the faculty senate. So, you know, the fact that we comment on it, we may get referred to the faculty senate either way.
So then the other two, so general consensus seems to be there needs, it deserves some mentioning. The other two were budget and planning and CURW, which we, like I said, we have basically no recent history in. Does anybody feel strongly one way or the other?
Yeah. Well, I believe it's right, regarding what are these people being paid, that's part of the budget and planning, isn't it?
I guess.
As part of the fund, the money.
Yeah.
How can it not be somehow, some way, a previous faculty member, I'm not sure if she's still a member or not, but she was very concerned with a lot of buildings being built and other things being neglected. All of that's part of planning and budget. So what are the priorities? And if, even if we're not experts on budget and planning, shouldn't we be somehow informed and aware and have some comments?
Sure. Charlie.
I would like to just comment for a moment. I had a talk with Elmira Madgen, who is the replacement for Carolyn Ainslie, who was really in charge of the academic budget. And her view was that the most useful thing we could do is listen to general comments about the budget and priorities and so on, and she would be delighted to come and give us all a briefing about what is going on in the budgets. But in terms of having a committee that would delve into the details, which is what I was questioning as to whether that would be useful, I think her feeling was at the moment it would not be terribly useful, that the details of the budget are extraordinarily complicated, and there are big changes afoot. And so for the moment, it's probably more useful for us to listen to the general outlines of what's going on and offer our comments to her, who is, after all, the person who's going to make a lot of the decisions, and that was the most useful role for the Assembly to play.
I just wanted to clarify, I'm not saying have a committee.
No.
Mm-hmm. I'm just saying having some language in there just because we're doing it for the fact.
Right.
That's all I'm saying.
The point is that you have two different categories of discussion here. Mm-hmm. One is about two committees.
And one is about
a set of issues. So if you put budget and planning in with academic matters and make it substantial, not just a mention, but something that we are very necessarily interested in and should be involved with in the preamble somewhere, and leave the committee out, that makes a lot of sense. And I wanted to speak about CURW. I think one of the reasons that was brought up that we could drop CURW as a concern was that, or as one of our committees, was that the undergraduate, I think it was, there's an undergraduate committee to that effect.
It's under the Dean of Students.
Right. And what I wondered about, I know a lot of activities go on at CRW that aren't just having to do with the Dean of Students office. And I don't know whether we're talking about doing away with the committee, but having that also enter into, entered as one of the serious concerns we have, or whether or not we want to make a suggestion that a committee of some sort be in the UA that has significant Dean of Students, undergraduate and graduate student participation, perhaps much more is run by them, but that it be a UA committee, because it is a university-wide concern and body. So we can think about that. It relates back to, in some ways, our initial discussion, in the sense of what is the relationship between the different assemblies, including the faculty senate, and this body. And one of the things I commented on in mine was that we really need to have some buy-in language from the different assemblies about what we are doing vis-a-vis what they are doing. And until we have that, then I don't think we have to give away stuff to them, but I think we need to stand up and say, this is what we do, and we are multiple constituency body, and we are whatever clearinghouse, I don't know, or a focus, or we can be used by your assemblies to get things done that you might that you think have more impact than just on the constituency that you represent. And until we have that buy-in, I don't think we should give away any powers, which I think we've agreed not to do to them. So it's all related to this CURW issue, but it's the broader issue that I'm thinking about. How do we get that buy-in from them? It may have to do with culture of this place, of this body, but I think it more than that has to do with culture of the university governance, and how I'm particularly concerned, being a faculty member, about the lack of connection between the faculty senate and this body. I don't think the faculty senate takes it seriously at all. And in fact, they think that they can do things and should do things, at will, that affect the entire university, like the family services question. That's my rant.
Yeah. Jared, I think you were next.
I would definitely agree with Marty and Leon that although a committee is probably not exactly necessary, campus planning would, in some way, shape, or form, mm-hmm. fall under our purview. Yeah. As for to URW. Does someone with a little more experience than me who's been here in years past want to briefly comment on the dynamic between us and them? Because my initial reaction was that I thought they were like a little reluctant to include us in like in their day-to-day functions. And then the last thing regarding to Marty's concern, I just think ultimately, especially with the new charter coming in, it's up to us as an assembly to like enforce ourselves on campus. And, you know, go, I guess take it one step at a time, each individual area of campus, and try to get them to, I guess, respect us more or try to understand what it is that we're trying to accomplish. So I think in years past, it's been a little, I guess, hazy as to what it was we were trying to accomplish. But I think that the new charter definitely makes it, like, a lot more effective.
Maybe, Ari, can you comment on the relationship with CURW, or is there anybody in particular?
I can say that.
Yeah. Institutional memory.
A number of years ago, we actually had a meeting CURW, and there was some, there was a mutual disinterest, not a bad
not animosity.
Interest from the assembly people to work with CURW, and they felt no need to, with all the things they did, to have to come here either. And I think sort of that feeling has stayed, that hasn't changed, I think, over the years.
I have no idea really what our relationship with the CRW would be. I think, and I've noted an interest on this committee, just like we have the Judicial Committee, which I call the stick, but we're also very concerned about what I would call the carrot, mental health, tolerance, inclusiveness, those kinds of policies and things that affect the university, and, you know, religious, for many people, helps them through difficult times. And I mean, there's an aspect there, and you wouldn't want somebody shut out or not, you know, so there's an inclusiveness aspect. But I was wondering if the original intent of that committee maybe had evolved to kind of a larger set of life skills and issues that revolve around the university, in a sense that it's perhaps more than just CRW. You know, we just have a lot of those kind of processes on the university. Whether we need a committee or not, I guess I'm not sure. It really depends on whether there's a problem. But we have a long-term problem with people jumping into gorges. So
So my opinion with the CURW, I totally see what you guys are saying. Religion just, for me, is one of those things that, like, I don't know how to say this best, but basically fewer fingers in the pot sort of telling them what to do. So I would be very resistant to a committee which oversees CURW. I could be more receptive to delineating it out, but I do still recognize that we can comment on what we'll have authority to comment on any issue which affects the campus. And religion just to me seems like one of those things that it is a campus life issue, it affects everybody, but I'm not sure that it should be delineated as an item which we should have like eyes on top of. Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of agree that there's maybe not a need for a committee. I think the things we could do is have CURW come and talk to us about what they do, because I mean, I was a board member of CREST, which is part of CURW, and their doctrine is not religion, as we think of it, which you keep your fingers out of it. The fact they've been described by one of our vice presidents as the conscience of Cornell, not a religious conscience, but social conscience. That is, they're quite active in community development projects and things of that sort. So I think CURW is broader than just religious life as it's narrowly defined as institutional religion. I have the suspicion, though I wasn't here at the time, that it probably was integrated with the University Assembly because of its political activism and social political activism back in the 60s, early 70s. And it was thought not to be something where we're supervising them, but where they are actually part of an organ of the campus health and life and vitality. So having somebody come from CURW to talk about what they do, you know, might be a useful idea. And then also having somebody come from the committee in the undergraduate, is it just the undergraduate assembly, or is it in that has the
CPSA doesn't have one.
Well, then whatever committee it is that is involved in it outside of have somebody come and say what it is they do relative to it. And if there's nobody doing anything with CURW, then we can think about revivifying the committee so that it gets somehow linked more tightly to the campus life.
Okay. Maybe if we just get, because we got a couple of items, so let's get Ari, then Randy and Leon.
First of all, the historical CURW is one of the campus life committees, so once there was a giant division of campus life that had much of the non-academic administrative components of the university were housed in this one division, and when the University Senate was created in the late 60s, early 70s, it was given legislative authority over that whole department. And when the current assembly structure was created in the early 80s, some of those units were left under the university assembly supervision, and some of them were student assembly, which at the time included graduate students. So I don't think that there was any, you know, philosophic reason for CURW to be placed in the UA. It was because of the division in which it was housed. That's not to say anything one way or the other about whether it should be in any way. Another comment I just want to make about authority is the authority language has changed in this charter, and I hope it's understood that it provides in some ways more concrete authority than was previously articulated. It says that responsible administrative units must consult with the university assembly. So I think that's pretty clear cut for the unit issues that are articulated there, because there are specific university policies dealing with diversity and inclusion, transportation, campus code of conduct. I am personally not so clear on what academic matters would entail. So I think it would be helpful to have some more discussion about in what cases you would want academic units to go on the expectation that they should consult with the university assembly, because the notion behind this is that units, when they're developing policy, should make a determination that, oh, this policy needs to be looked at by the UA before we finalize it. So
I want to talk about that. But first, actually, Jim's way of talking about the carrot and the stick is very nice, that the UA has some interest in some bigger picture things that there isn't necessarily a committee for. All of a sudden, you find out you need both the carrot and the stick, and all both things together. And that's just what these academic matters are. There aren't certain committees that find this out how many credits of humanities you need to graduate and all that. But sometimes there's occasional matters that come up that are just bigger, either problems to solve or issues to bring up that may change things and make things better. And under this definition of academic matters that's clear, I think we could include budget and say, you know something, when you give a $400,000 bonus to one person, then so many jobs aren't going to be here for other people. There's just, it is an academic matter. And then we could call campus life an academic matter, the spiritual nature, that other conscious nature, and put it there and keep our foot in the door so we can say something. Should we have something to say? But if we have nothing to say, then there's no need to convene a committee.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll be brief. I agree with everything that Marty said, so I'm going to, you know, invite folks here from CURW. And also, Charlie, do you know Joey DeStefano? I don't know. Is the title
yes,
vice president?
Yes, I know him quite well.
Yeah, today I heard him give a presentation on the financial status of the university, even looking out to the year 2015. which was pretty impressive information to know about. So you mentioned some other person to invite. I don't know that person's name, but did Joanne and that person work together?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm just encouraging that either one or the other be invited.
Yeah, Joanne would be great too. I mean, either one of them would be just fine.
Okay.
And I know they would both be willing.
Yeah.
I've talked to Elmira, and I know Joanne well enough to know that she'd be willing. Sure.
Yeah, we can try and schedule.
We'll try and do that. I'm a little worried about time. One of the things we really want to talk about is the committee structure.
Yeah.
And you've got just a couple more there.
Just a couple. Let me mention them, and then we'll get to committee structure. So one other person mentioned delineating. There are some issues of authority, academic areas being one of them, and Ari mentioned this. When our authority might collide with the authority of one of the other assemblies, delineate how that would be, where the line gets drawn, how that would be resolved. Somebody mentioned to think about that. As Marty mentioned, changing the size, proportional representation, which definitely we do need to consider more. And then the...
I thought you said not changing.
Not changing. Well, the current draft changes.
The size,
yeah.
I'm just saying, I thought you said not changing.
Yeah, Marty's advocating not changing.
Okay.
And then... right now, the current draft has the dean of faculty as the representative from faculty who is a voting member of the UA and not the chair of the faculty senate. So why is it not the chair? Why is it the dean of faculty rather than the chair? So I think that's probably an issue for faculty largely to discuss amongst themselves.
I would simply argue that the speaker of the senate is somebody who tries to maintain order against order amongst the faculty, and that the dean of the faculty is the faculty's executive officer and is in charge of all their committees, and I think it would be much more useful a person to have as a member of this body. That's just my opinion, and I'm highly prejudiced, having been a former dean.
I second that.
Okay. All right, so that seems largely resolved. So let's get more to the bigger issues. I don't think this one will get resolved today, but we do need to talk about this. Do you want to take this over?
No, why don't you? You're doing a wonderful job.
Awesome. all right, so we've posed the general size of the body doesn't rather change. Committees, we have, I think, 9 or 8 committees proposed in the current draft, right? Committee for every area that we delineate authority over. And then we staff those committees in much the same way that we do now, with members from each constituent body, voting members from each constituent body, voting members from those departments with expertise. And we're proposing, instead of a UA member being a liaison, a UA member is now the chair and a voting member. So that's really the change. It has now been suggested, and it's something very much worth consideration, instead of having 8 or 9 committees for all of these areas, we follow a system which is a system like the trustees operate under for committees. It's a system like Congress operates under committees, and that's the committee is actually staffed by members of the university assembly. So rather than having one UA member per committee, you would have 4, 5, however many UA members we say, and that's the committee. And to do that, we would have fewer committees. Instead of 8 or 9 committees, we would have 3 or 4 committees with broader scope. So instead of having a committee for one area, a committee oversees sort of a broader umbrella that several of these areas fall into. And remembering that the principle is that you say, oh, you have members from all the different constituencies, and they represent the diverse body. But we're all elected as representatives of those committees, and so we really do. Our role is to represent the diverse body. So it's you can kind of say that you need to look at your role on a committee broader than just you as being on the committee. And then this way, in order to get input on issues, you would. Testimony is the wrong word because it seems too formal, but the committee's job would be to solicit testimony from people who have issues that fall under in those areas that the committee oversees. If, say, one committee oversees is has the broad umbrella, but under that umbrella, say, transportation issues. If constituent members say, we have an issue with some transportation policy, the committee invites them to come and speak to the committee, give testimony, and then also asks for other people to give testimony on the other side of the argument or in support of their argument, and essentially holds like a hearing and information. But that's how you get. And instead of, since we're no longer having voting members from, say, in this case, transportation sitting on the committee, those people are ex officio members of the committee. So they know that they sit on the committee, they no longer have a voting role. So their role would be to come and, you know, give the expertise of that administrative unit or effective group on this issue which the committee is now discussing. Some of the advantages here are it makes a stronger link between the UA and committees. Presumably committees are supposed to be where the bulk of work gets done. So you have four or five UA members on a committee doing the bulk of work for that issue. It comes back stronger to this body with more people talking about that issue once the committee has hopefully functioned better. I'll kind of leave it at that.
Could you read a list of the committees? I'm afraid I didn't memorize it. What ones are you talking about?
Well, this proposal would essentially this is a significant departure from what we have now. So
right.
There wouldn't be a sustainability committee. There wouldn't be a transportation advisory committee. There might be, I don't know, a facilities committee.
Infrastructure, family, judicial, and then a miscellaneous one.
Yeah, Jared and I were talking about
infrastructure.
We were trying to, when we were talking about this at the exec meeting, what would be these maybe umbrellas? These are just proposal ideas for what the umbrella would be. So maybe
so you'd get rid of the Transportation Advisory Committee, except that it would exist because the Transportation Advisory Committee is the sort of standing committee of the Transportation Department and Mail Services Department, right?
I mean, they're allowed to have their committee. It just
they already have it, right? I mean,
but within the UA, it's our consolidated.
So that, like,
yes, I know it's our committee, but one assumes, I mean, I've been at that committee meeting several times, and you have too, you know? I mean, it's a big committee, and it's not, even though it's our committee, we sometimes didn't even call it. It comes on its own.
Mm-hmm.
So they probably would continue with their committee. It's just we wouldn't have a seat on it.
Wants to speak. Enumerating the committees that are in the proposed charter, there's a public safety committee, both in judicial, sustainability, transportation, child care, family services, and camp planning. Of those, the only committees that would be independently chartered of the UA, regardless of whether the UA took ownership of them, are campus planning and public safety. The other committees are creatures of the UA, including transportation.
No, I appreciate that, but we know that transportation exists despite the fact that it's our committee as an independent entity in the sense that they do have their meetings. That's all I'm saying. So under this new structure, we would have our own kind of big committee, and they probably would spin off and say, well, we're not part of the UA. We don't care that much anyway because we convene no matter whether we are or not. And we'll just go our own way. The only difference would be we don't have a seat on that committee, and we don't participate in its deliberations.
I mean, all right. So as the liaison to the PAC for the past 2 years,
right.
I would say, so I haven't run this idea. I ran previous ideas by Dave Lee, who's the assistant director of transportation. He has exact title. I would say if we were to propose this to him, they're free to have their own committee, right? But I think that if this were structured properly, it wouldn't be inconceivable that he would say, well, transportation talks about the same stuff year in and year out at this committee. The most regular people who show up to this committee are actually members of the transportation department. They're not students, faculty, and staff. They can have their own little, admin meetings, but those transportation issues, which do come up regularly, would be the ones where we've now said, David, you're ex officio member of this, I don't know what we would call the umbrella committee. but when transportation issues come up to our committee, part nighttime parking permits, which he said in our meeting is something he sees about every 2 years. You know, when this issue comes up, you will be there, we'll get testimony, we'll deal with that issue at the UA committee level.
Okay, and then just, as you say, let him go and do his business, whatever he wants to do.
I mean, to be honest, just knowing the guy tangentially, I would imagine he would probably be receptive to the idea of not having to keep holding
a committee meeting.
A specific committee meeting, yeah.
And planning would be the same, probably, because the planning committee I don't think it would be the same. Actually, the planning committee meets with all the people from grounds and everything else, and they talk about lots of stuff. They approve plans for buildings or stand in the way of them for as long as they can, and those kinds of things. And what would be the difference is we wouldn't have a seat on that committee. We wouldn't participate in their deliberations, except when we got angry about something or something like that, or concerned about something.
Let me see if I can help here. One of the issues is to require these administrative units, if they have a change in policy, to have consulted with the UA. That's one of the big changes in this charter. And I think that gives the UA real teeth. And that means that these committees that we're talking about cannot be ignored by the planning people or by the transportation people. If they want to get their things approved, they have to certify or show that the UA has been consulted and talked with about it. And I think that's where the leverage comes from. And the issue of how it's structured is a somewhat different one. And I think what we're proposing is a much stronger involvement of the UA members in this kind of committee work. And it has a drawback in that it means more work for UA members because they're going to have to be on committees. But it also, I think, improves communication and should make the thing more effective, I think.
I think it's a wonderful idea to have more strength, and I like that. I'm a little wondering about this, and you can get a scenario for it. What constitutes a policy? Because a lot of the things the planning committee does and the transportation advisory committee, they can say, oh, this isn't policy change, and it's an immense change in terms of the layout of the campus. And you know, it may be that we've been derelict in our duty in the past to attend these meetings and to keep our ears peeled for particular, you know, significant changes on the life in the campus. You know, I'll be the first to admit that's possible. That's been the reality. On the other hand, if we say, well, we're going to be there, you know, make sure you bring all policy to us. You know, we could find all kinds of things that would go on that we say, whoa, when did that happen? Oh, well, it's not a policy change.
Yeah, I think we've got to be careful of that language. I mean, that's the real issue.
Yeah, the key is, what do we do when we find about something in arrears?
Yeah, which is most of the time.
Yeah, well, that's how it will be.
Yeah.
Now, the hope is to not find things in the rear. Sorry, were you next?
Yeah, I want to just, I feel like there are two different questions here. One is the trigger question. When is the UA's authority triggered? When is it a policy that merits UA review? And then there's the question of, if it merits UA review, how does the UA go about doing that? What kind of process does it provide? Now, the committee restructuring thing, I think, mostly has to do with the second question, which is, would it make more sense for UA to have fewer committees? Would it make more sense to have those committees be UA members and to get community feedback through some sort of notice and comment period? I think the trigger question is, you know, there's this must consult, but there does need to be an identification over time of exactly what policies. I certainly think that, first of all, there are official university policies. I think there's some potential that perhaps the university simply could be plugged into the official university. I think, personally, that's just my
if you've dealt with the policy machinery, one would wish to avoid.
I think there is the room to identify specific policies.
Jim, I think you were next.
Well, I think Jared.
Oh, Jared, yeah. I'm sorry.
I think there's also an issue with like uniformity, because how are we going to address if like one of the committees like the CJC,
mm-hmm.
like we're not necessarily going to want to break that up, right? Like we're not going to want to turn that into a 3 or 4 person committee.
No.
So we have to decide, are we going to make it uniform, or are we going to be able to say like, yeah, we're definitely willing to have some of these committees be under this new umbrella structure and then have some of them be under the old structure.
Good.
And that's a very important decision.
That's a good question.
I think you'd be forced to hybrid. The second is if you're going to call it a trust but verify, you know, that they have to self-report things, then you probably need to put something in the policy that requires meeting minutes be kept and submitted to the UA about your proceedings, and then we can get briefed on those at the next meeting and determine if there's something we have a question on, or if we think it might touch policy, and maybe they honestly didn't foresee or didn't see the connection. But there would need to be something that allows us to, in a realistic, real-world manner, you know, try and circumvent and help the process work properly in a meaningful way without trusting on somebody going, oh, I don't want the UA involved in that. Make sure there's not the minutes, or, you know, I mean, there are many ways to skin cat, I guess, so.
Yeah, what I was going to say is similar to that is, so you must consult, but if you don't, so what's the enforcement? So what's the consequence? And then if it's well after the fact.
Yes, we're outraged. Outraged, I tell you.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is true. I guess, we'll revisit this.
Hi.
Welcome, gentlemen.
This is too scary. Just with the student leaders, and I asked one of the student leaders, are you going to this meeting? And he said, absolutely not. Didn't say it quite that way, but. All right, I'm going to get away from this air blowing on me. How are you guys doing?
Good. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming.
Well, thank you for turning that down a little bit.
Well, it was on low.
Oh, really? No, it's not. I'll be trying to talk to get going. I think I owe you an email, maybe. I can't remember. I think I do. Or something. I owe you something. You sent me something.
Money.
No. Yeah, I apologize. I'm a few days late on my stuff, but I know I have some from sometime between now and when my TIA craft kicks in, I'll get back here. Anyway, how's everybody? How are we doing so far?
We've been having a very interesting discussion about the revision of the charter and trying to get things simpler and more straightforward, and in due course it will arrive on your desk to approve or alternatively not approve. And we hope that you will look favorably on it, since the basic idea is to simplify things. And we've been having a lot of interesting discussions in just the last few minutes about the whole structure of committees, which Tommy knows all about, since he was one of the instigators behind the idea of having committees staffed more by UA folk than by just our casual people off the street, as it were.
Which category do you fall in?
Off the street.
Okay. So when Charlie, do you think I'll see that, the charter revisions?
I would guess another couple of months, because I think it's going to take some more discussion here. We've been getting ideas, and I think we're going to go back to the drawing board in some ways. So I think it's going to be a few months before you get it.
Okay.
The other thing that has been some discussion in the executive committee, though we haven't discussed it as a group, is that we are concerned, among other things, with the child care enterprise, and we are aware of the motion that's been passed by the Faculty Senate. But we also have a committee that's been working on this process, and our hope is that at the next meeting they will come and meet with us, and we will have some other folk, and in due course you might get a recommendation from the University Assembly about what we think might be done. So this is just a heads up.
When do you think that recommendation might get to me?
Well, I think it's going to take at least a month, because our next meeting is a month away. When?
The only reason I ask is that the Faculty Senate resolution asked me to respond by November 1. Now, the ad hoc faculty committee that worked on this work for 4, 5, 6 months and I was given about 6 weeks, and I might or might not make the November 1 deadline, but I'm trying diligently, of course, to be responsive to a shared governance resolution. I'm just saying that if I got input from you all, you know, in the same time frame that I was considering that, obviously it'd be helpful.
We will do our very best to do that.
Yeah, and it wouldn't have to be, you know, a huge formal document, but anything that would be helpful, to wit, we agree with the resolution, we disagree with the resolution, or we think you ought to go slow and more things to be considered. Those are sort of the three universes of response. Mm-hmm. So anything you could do to help me, I'm going to try hard to be responsive by November 1. You know, but it remains to be seen. I want to do a careful job.
Well, and so do we, and that's why we didn't want to just jump
right
into it
we
support the Faculty Senate's resolution. We may end up there, but we haven't considered it as a body, and so it's premature for me to speculate.
You know, one thing that would be very logical about that from my perspective, and I haven't looked at the stuff in detail because I'm waiting to get formal feedback from people who've been running the center, but one thing that I think would be logical about this group weighing in, however that opinion goes, is that I want to say this with all respect: the faculty are a minority of the users of the center, like they are in every university that I know about. Because in every university, the faculty are a minority of the people at the university. So there's 30,000 souls at this university. If you count the fact that Tommy and I have souls, 20,000 students, 1,700 faculty, and 8,000 some staff. And so I think it would be logical to get input. By the same token, any governance body that sends me something, I take it seriously. So I'd love to hear whatever it is that you think about it. It would be very, very helpful.
Good.
We have a follow-up meeting scheduled possibly for the 13th of October. We could conceivably do something there.
Yeah.
It's possible.
The suggestion.
I thought about you today because I met with the president of the University of Indonesia here.
Yes.
And did you see him?
No, I haven't yet.
Okay. Well, you've seen him?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
We talked about Gamelin.
Huh?
Didn't talk about you. I didn't want to scare him away.
I'm retiring.
What else is on your mind tonight?
Well, I think we had one of the questions we had for you was what kind of things do you see coming in the next year where we could play some kind of useful role? I mean, clearly the child care is something where I think we can at least express an opinion after we've considered it. But are there other things that you see coming down the pike where we could perhaps be useful?
Sure. Yeah, I think there are for sure. Forgive me, I haven't thought about this, obviously, so this is off the cuff, but one thing that's going to happen this year is that the strategic plan that was developed by a faculty group, and that's obviously a high-level aspirational plan that sets out priorities for the university, and I'm acting on those priorities in order. First priority was faculty excellence, faculty renewal, and we have, for example, a $100 million initiative for faculty hiring and so on. I take it very seriously is what I'm saying. This year, there will be the beginnings of implementing the plan where the rubber meets the road, I mean at the collegiate level and unit level. So I'm not sure my office exactly, but Tommy's office, every VP office, every dean, you know, will be asked to look at their operation and view it. It's not to create 14 laborious strategic planning groups, but I mean just to look at how you can line that up. And so the process by which that's done and the outcomes and so on, this is the shared governance body that covers the whole waterfront, and maybe I could ask you to keep them apprised. You'll be the one helping Kent to communicate those plans, and we'll be talking about that soon. So that would be one. Another one is after the horrendous events of last year with the suicides, as you all were recalling, in the April time frame, I can't remember exactly when, I think it was early April, I asked Bill Fry and Kent Fox and Susan Murphy to coordinate some sort of overview of the student experience oriented toward concern about the environment for student health and well-being.
and that's ongoing. I know that there is work going on at Gannett to further improve the how can I put this? Be responsive to client concerns about how services are delivered and be as responsive as possible and so on. I know that there are discussions going on, I believe, in the faculty about advising. I think that's correct.
I don't know.
Okay. And then there are discussions, I'm told, going on about the academic calendar.
Yes, I do know about
and,
that.
And some other things in that general, within the academic purview of the faculty. And at the student leaders meeting I was just at, we were talking with SA and GPSA leaders and others about you know, their points of view on campus climate. So hopefully we won't have a year like last year for a very long time, but there's no sense in not taking advantage of the fact that we've just been through such an experience. It's close to people's consciousness, at least it's close to mine. And I think anything that you would feel interested in commenting about the campus climate for student and staff and faculty health and well-being, I think would be good. There's a couple other issues. One issue has to do with transparency of information coming from the administration. So it's an issue that you brought up on occasion. Now, I'm 27 of my 31 years of higher ed. I've been in public institutions. That is, on faculty, public institutions. And so, you know, in those institutions, there's a certain level of transparency. It doesn't cover personnel issues. It doesn't cover certain aspects of issues that are litigious in nature. But it does cover many more things that are private institution. And I think all of us in this day and age, all of us in private and public institutions, this is a strong statement, but I believe it to be true, are trying to find the sweet spot between efficient, organized running of an institution and transparency. They don't have to be at odds with each other. And whether we've hit the target or not, I think Tommy will confirm that I've tried to push the pendulum toward the transparent side since I've been here. Well, in the sense that, for example, when we had those academic task forces, we put the summaries of those out, the provost decisions on those, which to pursue, which to ignore, which to study further, went out there. And there's other issues that might be coming up. One was a recent resolution from the SA regarding compensation. Some of the elements of that resolution and of the Daily Sun's coverage of it made me believe that I have failed, the administration has failed, to explain university finances of the campus. For example, Tommy, I'm sorry, I don't mean to answer editorials like this in public, but there was something on there about how it's the administrative salaries that have pushed up the cost of higher education. Administrative salaries maybe are 1% of the university's budget, something like that. They're very, very, almost a rounding error. But the only way you'd know that is if people saw the budget at the university. And we've tried very, very hard to get budgetary information out there. I'm confident more than it has been in a long time. So other help that you could give me, especially because of the fact that you represent students, faculty, and staff, about this issue of how to find the right point for transparency would be very helpful to me. We don't all agree on this. Not only maybe you and I don't agree in every single aspect of it, even administrators don't agree about how this should be. And so, you know, if that was something you thought was reasonable to talk about in concrete terms, that would be helpful. And if you didn't want to do something about it, that was, you know, a lot of work, like produce a document, let's just get together sometime and spend a half hour just talking about that or whatever, however you'd like to do it. That would be an area that would be helpful. Tommy is the main arbiter and conduit of what goes out there. So Tommy would be a very important part of that conversation, and whoever else, colleagues of yours, that
sure
thing.
Absolutely.
It would be great if you decide to have that discussion to do one more thing, which is my last idea, and that is the faculty group that produced the strategic plan kept using the phrase One Cornell, and I do think that it's a terrific time to try to think about institutional initiatives broadly. For example, the graduate students what was that here? I just looked at your website, but I think I'm stupid.
That's the name of our website.
Oh,
onecornell.com.
Why does anybody have, see, well, I think the website should be called Dave's a Great Guy, but anyway, and the grad student representatives from here, the GPSA, and the grad student student representatives from WIL just decided on the phone just now in the student leader meetings to get together and try to combine graduate student issues between the two camps. I think it's a really brilliant idea. It's a student-to-student idea. Why not do that? The MD students at WIL obviously don't have much in common with the undergraduates or grad students, the non-graduate MD, not MD PhDs, but MDs. But the PhD students in biological disciplines here and the PhD students in biological disciplines there have much more in common than they do have dissimilarities. And so the students decide to get together and form some common ground, common cause, and perhaps even, you know, common requests for changes in the administration. So it got me thinking when I was coming on the way here, there is no such thing as the UA at WILD. There's no EA at WILD. And who are the EA reps here? Okay. The three. Okay. Four. There's no EA type organization down there. There is a UFC kind of organization called the GFC, General Faculty Council.
No, but it's not the same.
It's not the same, but that's why I said type organization.
Thank you.
But the fact that it's not the same, still, there's no transaction between the faculty governance here and faculty governance there. So I'm not saying there ought to be, but I'm saying you could think about that issue. You could decide nothing more to be done. Or you could decide the grad students is a logical linkage. Let's have them do it, nobody else. But why not at this point think about what sort of commonalities? And those would be some things to think about.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Are there questions around the table? Randy?
Yeah, a number of years ago you wrote an editorial about mental health,
mm-hmm.
and Cornell, the healthy people reaching out to the less healthy people.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote to you and I thought that was courageous and the right way to look at things. And I think there's been a switch to say to the unhealthy people, seek service. And I would really like to see that focus come back to the healthy people.
Reaching out to each other.
Talking about myself. It's our responsibility.
Yeah.
To look out for.
See, this is a terrific critique of my communication. I really appreciate that because what I was trying to get across, obviously I didn't do it successfully, was both of those messages, Randy. I was trying to lower the stigma for people asking for help and also say if the person near you is struggling, whatever nature, you know, as a student, it could be someone down the hall or your roommate or whatever, that it's very important to say, you know, how you doing, what can I do to help, or if necessary, you know, urge them in the direction of getting some help. So I meant to say both things.
You did say both, but
I understand.
You
had
this balance.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe I'll give you 50-50. But
yeah, no, it's a very important point. Tom and I will talk about that. I think it's a very, very important point you're making because we're gearing up to have more help available. And we're going to face a little challenge, public challenge. The health reform law, healthcare reform law, has allowed students up to the age of 26 to be on parental policies. And that might or might not be a good thing for mental health services. It depends on whether one's parents' policies, first of all, are applicable in that geography, and secondly, whether they have coverage, mental health coverage, they might or might not. And it may be cheaper to do it that way. And so the cost pressures during a recession might actually push you in a direction that would give the students less good mental health coverage if they have not on student health insurance. And so it's really important time to focus on this. So we'll rethink these messages.
So I'm not talking about professional health.
No, I understand.
Time and caring.
Yeah. Yeah.
Contribute.
There's no question. I guess my only point about the healthcare law is that it makes it even more important to pursue whatever mechanisms everybody can pitch in on.
I sent an email to Charles Fox asking him
whether the people of color who teach the undergraduate pre-med program were consulted with the biology changes. And I haven't heard back from them.
Yeah, I'm not sure the answer to that. I think the, I could be wrong about this, I think the, I think Glenn Altshuler's organization is the one responsible for the liaison with the Qatar pre-medical faculty.
So what I can do is I can just try to coordinate between Glenn and
yeah,
and
just get an answer for you one way or the other. I mean, the faculty, they are teaching the courses, obviously, are the ones setting the curriculum. But I think the liaison to Ithaca is Altshuler's.
I guess part of the charter is that they teach the same year courses.
Once they're in medical school, the pre-med curriculum is different because in medical school here, there's no pre-med curriculum, obviously. They're coming from colleges all over. There, they're coming from high school. And so it's a 6 or 7 year trajectory from high school. So it's an unusual kind of a situation. It makes the point important. Tell me if you could do that with... And you think it is Glenn, is that correct?
I think so.
No, Glenn has the liaison function.
I think so.
Yeah. That's good.
Was there another comment, Leon?
Yeah, I wonder if you could comment on the Dream Act, because you put a lot of time and energy.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you had any comment.
Well, just disappointment that it didn't go anywhere. I thought it was going to go somewhere. I thought that, and Don't Ask, Don't Tell, we were going to get over the goal line on this year. And some sort of 0 for 2. But I've actually been getting a little bit of mail, not a torrent of mail, from people around the country who actually think it was a bad idea to advocate for the DREAM Act.
I just made an assumption that everybody knows what it is.
So the DREAM Act is an immigration related law that did not pass that would allow the children of illegal. Undocumented aliens to be eligible for public benefits for higher education, and if they completed 2 years of college or military service, to be in a pathway where they could attain citizenship. And the reason I was strongly in favor of it is that these are largely individuals who are in the country not because of their own act, but because their parents came. They could have been born here, they could have been brought here at a young age. They've been through the K-12 system. And if you don't allow people a chance to grow and learn and so on, then you're cutting them off and it's a dead end. And so it could have been a way for an organized path to citizenship if certain criteria are met, and a way to extend education and public benefits of education more broadly to people who are de facto living in the country. And we pushed it. Michael Crow, who's an old colleague of mine from the Midwest, is the president of Arizona State University, and we sent a letter to many, many, many educational leaders. Turns out educational leaders don't vote on laws, only elected officials do. And it didn't actually work out, but I think it would have been nice to do that.
Other comments? Ed?
Just briefly, I think the Sun reported online this afternoon that the endowment grew by 12.7%.
12.6,
which is great to hear. I'm wondering if that if that's a better growth rate than was anticipated, and that changes future decisions, or is that, are you going to, your idea to keep that money as a safety net backup more now?
It's a great question. Sorry, this is probably very boring, but I'll just remind you about the revenue that runs the university. This includes College of Medicine. 26% of the revenue that we use to operate the university comes from tuition. So the people who actually contribute the most monetarily are students and families. The next largest source of revenue for the university is the Physician Practice Plan in New York. It's about 20% of the overall revenue. But that money, of course, is used to run the healthcare. That's almost half of it right there between those two things. The state of New York, at the high water mark, we were getting about 10, 11, 12% of the operating funds. Some more money for capital, like we're going to build a redo stocking hall. But in terms of operating that capital funds, call it 10%, 11%, and that's going down. And you got to figure it's going to go down more with the way the state is right now. a very substantial part of the funds that run the university operating-wise are research funds the faculty earn. Most of those monies, of course, go to the individual faculty to run his or her project. The indirect costs go to the university to reimburse costs, and those will, I believe, stay stable or go up depending on the federal allocation to science agencies. The philanthropy to the university brings in about 6 or so percent of the operating funds of the university are from outright gifts, just 6%. And about another 10% are from endowment earnings. Outright gifts to the university have actually been surprisingly less affected by the downturn than I would have thought. So, for example, they haven't affected, but the so-called annual fund, which is where people give money to be spent that year, cash to be spent that year, which is in the $25 million a year range, very substantial money, is actually going up each year during the recession. It's astounding, astounding that it went up each year. It shows the loyalty that Cornell alums have for Cornell. The endowment earnings, that 10%, went down. That 10% went down 26%, or 2.5% of the budget, during the downturn, and is now on the way back up. So the first thing to remember is that it's a relatively small part of the revenue that runs the university. It's the first thing to know. Now, that's different than at some other schools. Some schools at Harvard are predominantly running endowment earnings, like the law school, business school. But at Cornell, because of the size of the student body, because of the relatively smaller endowment, although still massive, it's been different. It's also important in passing to remind, I always remind myself, out of 4,000 plus institutions of higher education in the U.S., only 60 of them, 60, have endowments of a billion or more. Or to put it a different way, almost nobody has endowments in the U.S. And then of that 60, a handful have 5 billion or more, like we had in 3 or 4 of them. We have these mega amazing endowments. So it's fabulous that we earn 12.6%. It brings us back toward where we were before, but it doesn't really affect the fact that we have to be disciplined. Happily, we're getting to the point now where if we can, with discipline, implement and live with the changes that we've designed, we're going to be past the crisis and we're going to be climbing up the hill again. We have to have the discipline to do that. I don't foresee any across-the-board personnel actions, anything like that. And modest as it was, the faculty and staff got slight raises this year, and plan for that to continue in the future. We have to meet 2 goals that I think are really important. One, and once again, I hope Tommy will confirm this, I don't want to budget all from our commitment for student need-based financial aid, even though we've taken that money out of the endowment right now. We have to keep doing it, otherwise the school will become unaffordable. And we're something like 7th most economically diverse student body in the country now, of schools of our caliber, because of that. And I say something like 7th because it's based on the number of percent of Pell Grants, and there's like 2 or 3 schools that have 14%, and a couple of us have 13% in the top 10. And then the other thing is we have to start hiring faculty at a better clip than we have been. So I think we're about 3/4 of the way toward balancing the budget, given the actions that are occurring this year. And hopefully the endowment will keep growing and people will keep putting money into it.
Well, we ought to let you go, but Marty, if you've got a quick one.
Well, maybe it's quick. I'm just wondering, are there any new directions in policy as far as capital improvements are concerned, that whether you're... I know, there's, besides Gates Hall, is there any thoughts about long-term new construction? And then the question subsidiary to that is there any assumption of long-term debt or short-term debt for Gates Hall?
Okay. Let me answer the second question first. No debt, not only in Gates Hall, but I won't approve any project that has long-term debt for the foreseeable future, period. Mm-hmm. So no debt for Gates Hall. There was debt, buildings that were very, very far down the line being planned before the construction pause, to wit Paul Milstein Hall, which of course I talked about many times, the medical research building in New York. Those we have assumed debt. Not allowing any projects to go through that assume long-term debt and Jace is going to be paid completely by three-fourths by philanthropy, actually the Gates gift itself and other philanthropy, and then a quarter by reallocation of funds in the colleges involved, the CIS and to some extent engineering. The other thing that we're doing though is allowing projects to go forward if all the sources of funds are known, and that was the case all the way through the construction clause. So if there's no long-term debt and all of the sources of money are identified and in hand, and that doesn't just mean designing it and building it and running it, and we do have, and you've been a terrific governor in this regard, the board passed a rule that we can't go backwards on 2.5 years ago, that all the new construction over $5 million has to achieve at least LEED Silver status. So Weill Hall, for example, is LEED Gold. We have other buildings that I hope will achieve LEED Gold. And that has two effects. It has the effect of following the ethos of the master plan, I think the ethos of much of the campus. It also has the result of making the projects more expensive, which I think is fine, is very reasonable. And
in
so,
the short term, but in the long term?
No, only talking about getting through the year, right. Basically. So, we're trying to balance all those things, but the university has very, very substantial long-term debt, like a lot of universities do. And just like families and businesses and whatever, we have to stop borrowing right now. And we've been able to do that. We did borrow, $500 million of taxable debt at the beginning of the worst part of the recession to have enough liquidity to keep going forward and not to back off on student aid and so on. We were able to not miss a beat on that, which is really terrific.
Well, David, thank you ever so much for coming.
No, it's good to be with you all.
Your conversation.
Hearing whatever you want to tell me. And please, if other things come up that we didn't have a chance to cover today, just send them right to me by email.
Okay. Thank you ever so much.
Yeah,
thank
good
you.
Evening.
Marty, Andy?
I'm trying to say something from before about the trigger. That I think Campus Planning Board Committee had a wonderful, provided a wonderful example of a trigger. They don't come to us when they want to know something about a particular building, but when they wanted a master plan to go through, they really wanted to ask for it. I thought that was a good example.
Okay. Well, thank you.
It's the 13th meeting, or are we just? It says follow up, and I mean,
if you want to engage on this, you need to have the 13th meeting.
Oh, I think so.
I think
if we want to really do
all
something.
Right. The 13th, is the day after spring break, fall break. Okay.
Recall university. Well, is everybody agreeing to that? The 13th, so we can then weigh in on something that we have a responsibility to weigh in on?
I'm definitely open to it.
Very clear. One November,
he's
weigh in.
Yeah.
Okay.
We have a year.
So let's do the 13th. We'll just talk about childcare issue then on the 13th.
Yeah.
Give a due diligence.
Yeah.
I think it's
fine. Yep.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.